Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is May the 26th, and we are in Parshas Baaloscha. Now, the truth is that we are up to page 782, in the beginning of chapter 10, Perek Yud. However, we are first going to go back. I sent an email to everybody that I made some mistakes in last week's class, and we first need to correct those errors before going further. Thankfully, this rarely happens, but there was one very serious error that I made, which is important that we go over. So, back on page 778, we went through the discussion of Pesach Sheni page 780. We went through the discussion of Pesach Sheni, that what happens if a person is Tamei, or if they are too far away from the temple, from the Beis HaMikdash, for Pesach, the Karban Pesach. So then we talked about offering the second Karban in Iyar. Now, let's just review the basics, the parts that we got correct last time, and then we'll talk about what I made a mistake about. So what we mentioned last time is the facts are that some people came to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they said to him, "We are unable to offer the karban because we are tamei." The Gemara discusses who they were, but they were tamei because they had come in contact with a dead body, and therefore they could not offer the karban at the right time. So thank you very much. So they thank you. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Okay, I'll ask Hashem." He spoke to Hashem, and Hashem said, "They get a second chance." A month later, rather than the 14th of Nisan, but on the 14th of Iyar, they can offer the Karban Pesach, or Pesach Sheni. That's what they can bring, and that will count for these people. And thrown in is not only those who are Tamei, but also someone who's too far away and could not get to the Beis HaMikdash, or to the Mishkan, depending where they were, couldn't get there on the 14th of Nisan, then they have the 14th of Iyar, where they could offer the karban. We discussed what it means to be too far away. That was accurate. We discussed again who these people were. That was accurate. The main mistake that I made last time is that, let me say the correct version first, and that is that anybody who missed the Karban Pesach for any reason, even if it was on purpose that they missed the Karban Pesach, could bring the Pesach Sheni. That was a grave error that I made. I had limited it only to what the Torah had said over here, which is those who are Tamei and the person who's too far away. That is not correct. The correct halacha is that anybody who misses the Karban Pesach is able to offer the Pesach Sheni. Doesn't matter why they missed the Karban Pesach. What makes a difference is that, as we've said before, the Karban Pesach is a very serious mitzvah. And if someone doesn't offer the Karban Pesach and they deliberately miss it, it's a very serious punishment. The punishment is kares, which is a very serious punishment. That's only if someone deliberately misses it. If someone was unable to bring it, Hashem doesn't punish a person who couldn't do something. But if a person deliberately misses it, they would get kares. A person who deliberately misses the Pesach Rishon could offer the Pesach Sheni and avoid the kares. But if he deliberately missed the Pesach Rishon, then when the Pesach Sheni comes around, it's not their fault. Something comes up and they can't bring the Pesach Sheni, they still get kares. Because since they deliberately missed the Pesach Rishon, they don't have any more excuses. They can't say with the Pesach Sheni, "Well, my car broke down, I couldn't make it." Well, why did you deliberately miss it the first time? So deliberately missing it the first time has an impact on a person who then misses the second one through no fault of their own. Because since the first one was deliberate, they are in trouble. Whereas a person who the first time didn't bring the Karban Pesach because they were Tamei, because they were too far away, something which they couldn't avoid, so then if the second time something comes up, then they would not have any, it would be by accident, they would not have any kares. So that's an important distinction, but the fact of the matter is that anybody can bring the Pesach Sheni if they miss the Pesach Rishon for whatever reason. Now, because I made that mistake, I forgot a Gemara and I made a second mistake, but you'll hear why. Somebody asked in the middle of class last time, what happens if a person converts between Pesach Rishon and Pesach Sheni, meaning that they were not Jewish on the 14th of Nisan. Between the 14th of Nisan and the 14th of Iyar, they became Jewish. Do they offer the Pesach Sheni? Similarly, what about a boy who's under Bar Mitzvah and his birthday, he turns 13, between the 14th of Nisan and the 14th of Iyar? Does he offer the Pesach Sheni? So because I was thinking that one does not offer the Pesach Sheni except for the reasons given here in the Chumash, which was a mistake, I answered that they would not offer the Pesach Sheni. That is incorrect. They would offer the Pesach Sheni. A ger, someone who converts between the two dates, between the 14th of Nisan and 14th of Iyar, would bring the Pesach Sheni, and a boy who turns Bar Mitzvah between those two dates would also offer the Pesach Sheni. So those were, it's really one error, but it has a couple of applications where I made that mistake last time. Yes?
Excuse me. Is it optional or
they have to? I believe that they have to. Yeah. I believe so. I don't want to say for sure. I made enough mistakes in this already, and we're going to avoid saying anything definitively. Yes, it's a good question. Now, another error that I made last time, but this one is not as egregious. Also, this one, it is possible that there are opinions that agree with what I said last time, but I couldn't find any. I only found opinions that disagree with what I said last time. I suggested last time that, see, the Torah never says when the Pesach Sheni is eaten. It says that it's offered on the 14th of Iyar. It doesn't say when you eat it. Now, if it follows the same pattern as the Pesach Rishon, well, the Pesach Rishon is offered on the 14th of Nisan, and it's not eaten until nightfall, till the 15th of Nisan. As we know, that's when we have it. We would have it if we had a carbon today. We would have it at the Pesach Seder. So if the Pesach Sheni follows the same pattern, then the same thing should apply, that the animal is processed, it's slaughtered, etc., in the afternoon of the 14th of Iyar, and then it would not be eaten until the evening, the 15th of Iyar. That is what would happen if it followed the same pattern. I suggested last time, there's no reason for it to follow the same pattern. The Torah doesn't tell us the rule, and there's no Yom Tov. It's not Pesach, as we mentioned last time. This is correct. It's not a makeup for the holiday of Pesach. It's only a makeup for the sacrifice. That's it. It's not. There's no yontif. There's no holiday. There's no seder. You don't drink four cups of wine on the 15th of Iyar. You don't. That doesn't apply. You don't tell over the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. There's no manishtana. You don't do any of that on the 15th of Iyar. So I suggested, therefore, one should be able to eat the Pesach Sheni already in the afternoon of the 14th of Iyar, and not have to wait until nightfall, the way you have to the first time around. It is not spoken about in the Chumash, it is not spoken about in the Gemara. As far as I know, Chazal do not address it, at least not in anything that we have, as far as I know. However, subsequent to last class, I actually mentioned this also in another group. I mentioned it to another shiur that I was giving, and subsequent to that, some of the rabbis in the community who had heard I said it found sources to show me that various Rishonim say explicitly that you have to wait until the 15th, till the nightfall, even for the Pesach Sheni. You cannot eat it until the nightfall, till the 15th at night, the 15th of Iyar at night. We'll give credit to Rabbi Asa, who showed me that the Rambam says explicitly the 15th of Iyar at night, as well as a Tosfos in Meseches Pesachim that says it as well. And after that, Rabbi Shkarovsky also showed me a Rashi in Meseches Pesachim that says the same thing. So the Rambam, Rashi and Tosfos all say the 15th of Iyar at night and not the 14th of Iyar in the afternoon. Again, it could be that there's someone out there who disagrees, but those are three heavy hitters. So we will go with the 15th of Iyar at night. We will say that it was a mistake and that in fact you have to wait till the 15th of Iyar at night to eat the Pesach Sheni, just as you have to wait for the 15th of Nisan at night for eating the Pesach Rishon. The one thing though that comes out from there, which is a little bit difficult to understand, which I pointed out last time, is that some people have accustomed to eat matzah on the 14th of Iyar, because it's the day of the Pesach Sheni. But the thing is, they didn't eat the Pesach Sheni on the 14th of Iyar. They ate it on the 15th at night. And that's very late, actually, especially in Atlanta. That means a very late eating of matzah. So I don't know how that minhag, and it's only a minhag, it's not a halacha, one does not have to do it, and even those who do it, if you get it wrong, you get it wrong. There's no consequences. I'm just wondering, what is the correct minhag for those who do it? So when should they eat the matzah? I don't know the answer then. I would have thought that they should have to wait now to the 15th at night, if that's when they had the Karban Pesach. Okay. Now, one other point because I made these mistakes, I did more research on the Pesach Sheni, and there is one more point that I'd like to share with you that dovetails with something else that we spoke about last week. We asked last week, irrespective of who is allowed to do the Pesach Sheni, which now we're saying everybody can, but the fact of the matter is, the ones who came to Moshe Rabbeinu to ask, they said, Lama Nigara, why should we be excluded? The ones who came before Moshe were the ones who were Tamei Meis, the ones who had become who had come in contact with a dead body. So we asked the question last time, why didn't anybody else come before Moshe? Why did only those? I mean, there's in any, you have a couple of million people, there's going to be a segment of the population that would not be able to bring the Karban Pesach for whatever reason, yet the only ones who came before Moshe Rabbeinu were the ones who had come in contact with a dead body. So why didn't anybody else come before Moshe Rabbeinu? We asked this question last time. We suggested last time because everybody else, it would have been their personal circumstances why they couldn't offer the Pesach. Okay, you know, every mitzvah, there are people, there are always exceptions, people who can't perform the mitzvah for whatever reason. But people who came in contact with a dead body, they're doing a mitzvah on behalf of everybody. The Chevra Kadisha, they take care of the people who have passed away. That really, we're all responsible to do that. And those who are doing it on behalf of the whole congregation, they're stepping forward and doing a mitzvah for everybody. So they came before Moshe Rabbeinu and said, why should we lose out on the Karban Pesach? A very strong question. So that's how we presented it last time.
So what if that Chevra Kadisha is the same Chevra Kadisha a month later at the 14th of Iyar,
yes.
And they're Tamei again?
Yeah, then they won't be able to do it.
But what about the Karis?
No, it's not on purpose.
Okay. Oh, yeah, it's only Karis, and it's on purpose.
It's not on purpose. No. Okay. It would be an exception for them. Yeah. I mean, a person who's Tamei both times, right, for whatever, he can't do it.
So the question came up is because they were carrying Yosef.
Yes, yes.
So what I thought Yosef was assigned only to...
No, it was the some. Yeah, they would have. What they would have done over here is they would have given that mitzvah to somebody else for the next month, so that they could be. Yeah, that's what they would do. So, in my research, I found that this is addressed in the Rishonim. It's based on a Gemara of why specifically these people came before Moshe Rabbeinu. It's a little technical, but we should explain it. Since we brought it up last time, we should explain the technicality. So the technicality works as follows. We know, as we mentioned before, there are various types of tumah. And some tumah lasts one day. Some tumah lasts 7 days. Some tumah lasts until the source of the tumah disappears. Like, for example, someone who has tzaras. Someone who has tzaras is perpetually tamei until the tzaras goes away. And they can't necessarily control that. They can do teshuvah for whatever avera they did, but if Hashem doesn't take away the tzaras, then they're tamei. And that's the way it goes. So tuma is one of those things that prevents the Karban Pesach, and tuma, there are different types of tuma. If a person has a one-day tuma, they go to the mikvah, the sun goes down, and now they're tahor. If a person has a seven-day tuma, they have to wait 7 days. On the seventh day, they go to the mikvah, the sun goes down, and then they're tar. Sometimes they have to bring a carbon the next day, depending on the type of tumma. And of course, if it's a type of tumma where the source of it is still causing tumma, they have to wait till the source of it stops. And then, depending on the type of tumma, they either can go to the mikvah right away, they have to wait 7 days, whatever it is, and then the sun goes down and they're okay. A person who contracted a one-day tumma on the 14th of Nisan, which is the day of offering the carbon. So that would be, for example, let's say a person touched a carcass of an animal that was not slaughtered properly. So they become tameh, but it's a one-day tumah. So they need to go to the mikvah that night. They'll be tahar. Now this person is in a funny situation. It's the 14th of Nisan. I touched that carcass. I'm tameh. I'll go to the mikvah, and then tonight I'll be tahar. The carbon is offered this afternoon. I'm tamei at the time of the offering of the carbon. But then the eating of the carbon is tonight. If I go to the mikvah today, then tonight I'll be tahar, and I'll be able to eat from the carbon. So am I included or excluded from the carbon Pesach? On the one hand, I'm tamei at the time that it's offered, but I'm tahar at the time that it's eaten. So, what category am I in?
So you could do it if you have a shaliach.
Okay, so you can have, not everybody went and slaughtered the Karm Pesach. After all, you were in a group. Right. So the halacha is, you are included. You get yourself included in a group. You obviously can't be the one to take the animal to the Beis HaMikdash, because I'm still Tamei that day, so I can't bring the animal to the Beis HaMikdash. I can't be the one to slaughter the animal. But one of the members of my group, who is Tar, can take the animal and have it processed. Tonight, when it's time to eat it, and it's time for the Seder, I will be Tahar, and all is good. That is true for any type of Tumah that the person is ready to go to the mikvah on the 14th of Nisan, and will be Tahar that night. Except for Tumas Meis. If someone is Tameh, having come in contact with a dead body, and the 14th of Nisan is the seventh day of his Tumah, so he'll be able to go to the mikvah, and then that night he'll be tahar. He cannot eat from the Karm Pesach, because since he was Tamei Meis, so he was on the bringing of the Karm Pesach, he is excluded. So that's why they came to Moshe Rabbeinu. They were saying, everybody else who's like us, we're Tamei. Okay, fine. But today is the 14th of Nisan, and today we're going to go to the mikvah. It's the seventh day for us today. And tonight, we will be able to eat, we'll be tar. Everybody else who's in the same predicament we're in is able to do this. They're able to go to the mikvah today, and then tonight eat from the Karm Pesach. We are the only ones who are excluded. Lama nigara, why should we be excluded? Now, they weren't asking to change the law. That rule is not changed. Someone who is Tamei Meis, who goes to the mikvah on the 14th of Nisan, cannot eat from the Karm Pesach that night. But they were saying, but we seem to be, have gotten the short end of the deal. Everybody else is able to do this. So why should we be excluded? To which Moshe Rabbeinu asked Hashem, and Hashem said, we'll give them a different day. They can't do it that night, but the 14th of Iyar will be their makeup date. So that's the Rambam explains this, that's why these are the ones who came before Moshe Rabbeinu to ask for a makeup date. Yeah?
Was this Pesach observed at Har Sinai?
This Pesach was observed in Har Sinai, yes.
Then, what were they carrying?
Yeah, that's a good question. We brought this up last time, that they weren't traveling, so when they had Yosef's bones...
And the brothers,
right? Then there was no need to carry them anywhere, so they didn't need to be tummy. But it could be they still attended to the coffins. You know, they probably didn't just leave it in a tent for 6 months, or 8 months, or 10 months. So they were at Har Sinai for almost a year. So they probably needed to check up and make sure everything was okay with those coffins. So if they walked into a tent and the coffin was in the tent, then they became tummy. But the Gemara says that there were other, I mean, if people died all the time. It was a nation of several million people, that everyday people die.
I thought before the sin of the spies that people didn't die.
I don't know that to be true. It could be you're right, But I don't know
that. That was the whole thing, right? And after they signed it, this, and every Tisha B'Av, everyone would go. Like,
yeah, well, that was they died at age 16. That was a punishment.
Right.
But I mean, there's still old age. I don't remember seeing anywhere that there was a miracle that no one ever died. You know, it's a regular nation of people. People die. I mean, that's, you know, that's the way life works.
Now, we may have discussed this in the very beginning of this Korban Pesach thing. Women are obligated.
Okay, so women are obligated in Pesach. It seems that Pesach Sheni is optional for women. Pesach Rishon, women are obligated. Pesach Sheni is optional. I don't want to say this authoritatively, but what I saw in my research this time around was that there is a particular, really, women should be exempt from Pesach Rishon and Sheni because it's a commandment, it's positive, it's not negative, and it's very time bound. Right. So women are generally exempt, and therefore it should be optional. Both the first Pesach and the second Pesach should be optional for women. However, we have, the Torah says explicitly that women are obligated in the Pesach Rishon. Similar to most of the laws of Pesach, women are obligated. Women are obligated to eat matzah, women are obligated to eat maror with the Korban Pesach.
Karis is also relevant to women? For an opportunity?
For Korban Rishon, yes. For the Pesach Rishon, yes. Yeah, that would be, I believe so. Very careful. I believe so. And the four cups of wine, which are rabbinic, women are obligated in, right? We know that Pesach is essentially the same for men and women. But that pasuk that tells us that women are obligated in Pesach Rishon, that pasuk is not repeated with Pesach Sheni. So with Pesach Sheni, it would revert to the default, which is that it is a time-bound positive mitzvah, rather than a prohibition, and therefore women would not be required, but it would be optional. And that's, I believe, the way the Rambam understands it. Yeah.
First question. Do women bring the Korban Pesach? Or is it only a man who brings the Korban
Well, only Kohanim can actually process a Korban.
Right, I know. But a group of people brings a
Korban Pesach. Could you have a group of women? Could you have a group of women?
The case that it's a husband and their family, but all the children are under
age. The Gemara discusses, could you have a group exclusively of women for the Korban Pesach?
Why
would you not be able to? It does. There are certain groups that the Gemara says not to have, just because the group is not an appropriate group to have together. Just because they're, you know, the promiscuity that could go on. So I believe it is explicit that women could form their own group, but not Pesach Sheni. Let me just think for a second. Pesach Sheni, I think not, because everybody is only optional in that case. So Pesach Sheni, I think you have to have men in the group, but Pesach Rishon,
because they have to have the same requirement, right? To fulfill it, if they have to do, they have to have the same obligation, like women, if they don't have the same obligation.
I went through this. This is what I remember. I believe that's the case. But Pesach Rishon, I'm pretty sure that yes, women, you can have a group of just women for the Pesach Rishon.
Does Nida make a woman tame that she can't participate?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I didn't say that explicitly last time, but I was trying to allude to that last time. Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. People are going to be tummy. That's the way it works. I mean, you always have a group that can't do it. Yeah.
Why do you go to mikvah during the day?
Why you do or don't you?
You do. You said you go during.
Oh yeah. It's an interesting thing. We're used to mikvah being at night, mm-hmm. right? Because for nida, for family purity, so the women go at night. But the truth is, that's an exception to the rule. Almost all types of tumah, mikvah is daytime. Nida is one of the exceptions. In fact, there's a Mishnah that says, all those who go to the mikvah, I forget the exact language, are all daytime, except for, and nida is one of the exceptions. So we're used to thinking about it as a nighttime thing, where really that's an exception to the rule.
Is there more than one exception?
There are two exceptions, I believe. I think neither one other. I don't remember offhand what the other one was.
So if she goes at night, if she goes that night, can she still participate?
Yes, so I saw that discussed, but I don't remember the answer to that question. I don't think so. I think that she has to go the previous night in order to be able to eat the karmas, but I don't remember. I don't know if that works. Okay, so I believe that we have corrected all the wrongs from from Pesach Sheni. We get a second chance for Pesach Sheni. See that? Okay. Now we'll move ahead to page 782. For the recording, and this is people. I didn't send in last week's recording because I have to deal with all the mistakes. But here we corrected everything, so we'll see how we handle the. I don't want people to listen to last week's recording and not listen to this week's recording and get it all wrong. So we'll have to figure out how to handle that online. Okay. Page 782, Perek Yud Pasuk Aleph, chapter 10, verse 1. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemar, Hashem speaks to Moshe, saying, Asei lecha shtei chatzotzos kesef, make for yourself two trumpets of silver. Miksha ta'aseh osam, they should be made miksha. Miksha means, we've had this one before, piece. That is right, it has to be one piece of silver, which is then shaped into trumpets, into a trumpet, each one its own, and it's two different pieces of silver, one for each trumpet. And you can't take pieces of silver and somehow affix them to each other, solder them, or whatever the process is of connecting one piece of silver to another. You can't do that. It has to be a solid piece of silver for each of these trumpets. They should be for you for calling together the congregation, and to have the camps travel. Now, at this point, if I were to ask you, what are these trumpets for, you would answer me exactly what we just read. These trumpets, they serve two purposes. One is to call together the congregation. That means if Moshe Rabbeinu needed to speak to everybody, he would have the trumpets blown, and that would signal for people to come and gather before Moshe, that he would speak to everybody and tell them whatever it is that he needs to tell them. The second use would be blowing the trumpets in order to signal that it's time to travel, and that the various camps would travel at the various times. Clearly, you have to blow the trumpets in different ways to indicate different signals, which the Torah is now going to describe how they're blown. One type of blow will indicate gathering together, another type of blow will indicate traveling, and we're about to see that. But the truth is, as we'll see at the end of this paragraph, there are other uses for these trumpets besides these two. The reason why these two are singled out is because these two uses were for Moshe Rabbeinu. The trumpets are something which are ongoing. There are trumpets in the Beis HaMikdash in the temple, which will be used for the purposes we'll see at the end of this paragraph. But Moshe Rabbeinu used the trumpets for something else besides the ongoing use that we'll see at the end of this paragraph. He used them for gathering the people together and for traveling. In addition to that, it says, "Asei lecha, make for yourself." These trumpets of Moshe Rabbeinu were put away when Moshe Rabbeinu died. The trumpets, these two trumpets, were specific to Moshe. No one else was able to make use of them. They were only for Moshe. I don't mean he is the one who blew them, as we'll see, the Kohanim blew them. But Moshe Rabbeinu, they were for his purposes. When he died, they were put away. New ones had to be made for use in the Beis HaMikdash after Moshe's death. So, for Moshe right now, we're describing two uses. One is to gather the nation, the other is to travel. So, the Torah continues, Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, V'sak'u bahein, they would blow on them, blow a tikiyah, V'no'adu elecha kol ha'edah, and all of the congregation would gather to you, El Pesach or Amoid, to the entrance of the Mishkan. Now we know that when you blow on a shofar, which is a form of a trumpet, there's a tekiah and there's a teruah. The tekiah is one long blast. That's a tekiah. Then there's a teruah. Now because we don't know exactly what a teruah is, therefore, on Rosh Hashanah, we blow it three different ways. We blow it with that quick stutter, We blow it with three longer ones, which we call a shvarim, and then we blow the two of them together, shvarim trua, right? That's what we do on Rosh Hashanah. That's because we don't know what a trua is, but the Torah knows what a trua is. So there's really only two types of blowing. There's a tekiya, the one long one, and then the trua. So if you want to gather everybody together, you blow both trumpets and you blow a tekiya. And that indicates to everybody that you should gather before the Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu has an important message. Vim ba'achas yisko, Pasuk Daled verse 4, and if you blow one of the trumpets rather than both, v'nu'adu ha'ilecha ha'nesiyim, then the princes, the leaders of the tribes, will gather to you, Rosh Ha'alfei Yisrael, the heads of the thousands of the Jewish people. I mean, if you want only to speak to the leadership of the Jewish people, those who are leading their individual tribes, then you should only blow one trumpet. Apparently, it's easy to hear whether two trumpets are being blown together or one trumpet is being blown alone. And if only one trumpet is blown, then the nation knows that it's not for them to gather, but only for the leadership to gather before Moshe Rabbeinu. Uskatem teruah, and then if you want it, this is going to be for traveling. If you blow a teruah rather than a tekiya, you blow a teruah, then v'nasu ha-machanos ha-chonim kedma, then those who dwell in the east will travel. That's the camp of Yehuda, which dwelled in the east. They were the first ones to travel. When the teruah was sounded, then they would travel. The Gemara explains that when it says uskatem teruah, it means actually not just a teruah, but it's more similar to what we're used to on Rosh Hashanah. Tekiah, teruah, tekiah. That's what it means. That if they wanted to travel, when it was time to travel, they would blow tekiah, teruah, tekiah. The long one, the one that we're not sure about, and then the long one, and that would be that would indicate that it is time to travel. And the camp in the east, which is Yehuda's camp, would travel. Uskatem trua shenis. Then you'll do another tekiya terua tekiya. V'nasu ha-machanos ha-chonim temana. And then the camps in the south, which is the camp of Ephraim, they would travel second. Trua yisku l'masehem. They would do a tekiya trua for their traveling. Every time that they needed to, that the next camp would travel, they would blow a tekiya, teruah, tekiya. Uva'akilas akahol, but when they would gather the nation, which is what we said before, tisku'u, only blow a tekiya, velo sariu, don't blow a teruah. So as Rashi sums it up, a tekiya with both trumpets is to gather the whole nation. A tekiya with one trumpet is to gather only the heads of the nation, but there's no trua in both those cases. Tekiya, trua, tekiya is the travel sound. And then they would travel. Each tekiya, trua, tekiya would indicate the next camp travels of the four camps. Uvenei Aaron HaKohanim yisku'u b'chatzotzeros, and it would be the sons of Aaron the Kohanim who would blow these trumpets. V'ayu lachem l'chukas olam l'doros seichem, they will be for you as a statute forever for all of your generations. Now, it can't be for all your generations because we don't travel. Well, but you mean today because we don't really know. But I'm saying even when we had the Beis HaMikdash, if they're not traveling and they're not gathering to Moshe Rabbeinu, so what is it for all generations? So the Torah is about to explain how they are used in an ongoing fashion as for all generations. Before I read the next part to you, though, I want to explain that we are used to the blowing of a shofar. We do that on Rosh Hashanah. The blowing of these trumpets were different. The trumpets were made out of silver. The shofar, of course, comes from the horn of either a ram or another animal, but that's what it comes from. So they clearly make a different type of sound. There were times in the Beis HaMikdash when they would blow both the shofar and the chatzotzros. There were times when they would do that. The Mishnayos and Maseches Tainis speaks about when there would be troubles and things like that, they would blow, as we'll see this in the Torah in a minute, they would blow both the shofar and the chatzotzros. And what they would do is that if the main mitzvah of the day was with the trumpets, then the shofar would stop. They would blow them simultaneously, but the one blowing the shofar would stop before the ones blowing the trumpets, the chatzotzros. And that would indicate that this main mitzvah of the day is with the trumpets, and therefore they would elongate their blowing. Whereas if it was the other way around, if the main mitzvah was with the shofar, again they would both blow, but the ones blowing the trumpets would stop abruptly, while the shofar would continue on to show that it's the main mitzvah of the day. So there were times when both were blown. So what were the trumpets, the chatzotzros, used for besides traveling and besides gathering the nation? Pasuk Tes, verse 9. V'chisavau milchama be'artzachem, when there shall come a war in your land, al hatzar hatzorer eschem. Al hatzar hatzorer eschem. So they translate that as an enemy who oppresses you. Then you shall sound the trumpets. What's the purpose of sounding the trumpets? You will be remembered in front of Hashem your God, and you will be saved from your enemies. So blowing these trumpets was a way of evoking the mercy of Hashem when there was a war. And that's fascinating. Why should it be that the blowing of these trumpets would somehow bring out the mercy of Hashem? I would have thought that we should daven when we're attacked, and that'll bring out the mercy of Hashem. But the Torah says, blow the trumpets, and that will bring out the mercy of Hashem. Next pasuk, uviyom, we'll come back to this in a minute, uviyom simchaschem, uvamoadeichem, uvarashechachechem, on the day of your happiness, your joy, the day of your holidays, the Rosh and on Rosh Chodesh, uskatem bachatzotzros, you shall blow the trumpets, al oloseichem, on your burnt offerings, valzivche shalmeichem, and on your peace offerings, and they will be for you a remembrance before Hashem. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am Hashem your God. So blowing when the sacrifices were offered on the special days, on the holidays, on Rosh Chodesh, etc., then the trumpets were sounded during the time of the bringing of the karbanos. Now we know that when karbanos were offered in the Beis HaMikdash, especially the communal karbanos were offered, the Levim would play music, they would sing, they would be beautiful accompaniment to the karbanos. Here we have an additional thing, that the trumpets are not really music, meaning what I mean to say is it's not playing a tune, it's sounding the trumpets. But that was also done during the karbanos. The Mishnayos in Maseches Sukkah and other places describe where exactly in the service the trumpets were sounded. And some services they were sounded many times at each significant stage. For example, when they went to go fill up the flask with water for Nisuch HaMayim, for the water libations on Sukkot. So there was a whole procession of going out of the Beis HaMikdash to the stream to fill the flask of water, bring it back, pour it on the Mizbeach. So in each significant stage, the trumpets were sounded. The trumpets meant that there's something important going on right now. And here again, you find that you will be remembered in front of Hashem when you do this. Yeah.
It's interesting. It doesn't say how they should be sounded, short or long or whatever.
That's right. It does not say. That the Gemara is left to figure out what the type of, you're right, is it one long blow? Is it tekiah trua tekiah? Yes. Okay, that's a good point. It seems it was primarily tekiah trua tekiah, but it's a good point. Now, you see, therefore, that the trumpets evoke that you will be remembered in front of Hashem in two ways. One is if an enemy attacks us, and two is for the karbanos. So, for the karbanos themselves are a mitzvah, and if we bring the karbanos appropriately, then we are remembered for good in front of Hashem. And apparently, the blowing of the trumpets was a way of marking those karbanos, and it brought out the specialness of the time, and that we are doing something important, and it would complete the mitzvah for Hashem. It's a little bit more difficult to understand the blowing of the trumpets for a war. If the Torah would have said, blow the trumpets at the war, and that will gather the army, that would have made sense to me. It's like the Minutemen. You blow the trumpets, and then the militia comes forward, now you have an army to defend the nation. But that's not what the Torah says. The Torah says, blow the trumpets, and you'll be remembered before Hashem. What does blowing the trumpets have to do with being remembered before Hashem in time of a war? So, if you'll hold the place here, I want to show you something which we'll get to, but I don't know when we'll get to it. It'll be a while till we get there. So, we'll take a sneak peek now. In Parshas Shoftim, which is in Devarim, towards the end of Parshas Shoftim, page 1038, We have the rules for what we are to do when we need to go to war. There's a nation that's attacking us or that's dangerous, and we need to go to war. We're in Israel, and we need to go to war. So we have a whole discussion over here about the army, who fights, who doesn't fight, and the marching orders that we get from the leadership before going to war. So the Pasuk tells us in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, this is referring to the Kohen. He says to the army, the Amar Aleihem, he says to them, Shema Yisrael, listen Jews, Atem Krevim Hayom Lamelchama Alei Veichem, you are coming close today for war with your enemies. Al yirach levavchem, your heart should not melt. Al tiru, do not be afraid. V'al tachpezu, don't tremble. V'al ta'artzu, what does that mean?
Don't be broken.
Don't be broken, mipnehem, from before them. Don't get scared. As the next pasuk says, ki Hashem alokechem ha'oleichim achem, because Hashem, your God, who is going with you, li lachem lachem, to fight for you, imoy veichem, against your enemies, lohoshia eschem, to save you. You have a weapon that no one else has. You have Hashem on your side. Hashem is there, and He's going to be fighting alongside of you. Don't be afraid of the enemy. So that's a good message for us Jews. Of course, you're going out to war. Remember, it's not our tanks, it's not our planes, it's not our weaponry. It is Hashem that is really saving us from our enemies. That's a great message. The Gemara wants to know, why is it that the Torah uses all these words for don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Don't let your heart melt. Don't be afraid. Don't tremble and don't be broken. It's a lot of words. What do they each mean? So Rashi explains, because the enemy, the secular armies would use various techniques to frighten the other army. When they came to do battle, they would deliberately do things that would scare the other side. What would they do? So as Rashi explains, I'll read it to you. Rashi says, Magifin bitrisehen, they would bang their shields together, like clang their shields together, to make noise. They would make their horses, make noise. What's the word for a horse to make?
Neigh.
Okay, right. They make their horses make noise. They would yell and scream. They would scream with their lungs. And they would blow shofros and all types of noisemakers to scare the enemy. Their point was to show their bravado and to appear to be much bigger than they really were. Noise can be a frightening thing. Noise can scare people. Noise done in the right way, or the wrong way, it can be very frightening. So that's what they would do. So here Hashem is telling us, when you go to war, I want you to blow on these trumpets. Now, why are we blowing on the trumpets? So back in our page, that's again, we'll discuss that more in detail when we get to it, but back on 782, so Hashem is saying, you should blow on the trumpets, but I don't want you to do it the same way that the rest of the world does it. The rest of the world does it with the intention of frightening the other side. That's not what I want you to do. Why don't I want you to do it that way? Because if you do it that way, you're only reinforcing the notion that winning or losing is about you. Winning or losing is about me, about my army, about my strength, my comrades in arms. Right? The way we're going to win is because of our weaponry, because of our courage, because of our skill. Blowing the shofar to scare the other side is reinforcing it's all about us. Hashem says, I don't want you to do it for that reason. I do want you to blow on the trumpets, but I want you to do it to be remembered before me. As the Rambam explains, they would blow the trumpets and daven. The blowing of the trumpets was done along with the davening. In other words, before they would go out to war, what they would do is, of course, they would probably say Tehillim. Well, what else would you say? I mean, in those days, they didn't have Tehillim yet. But what would we do? We have to go to war. God forbid. What would we do? We say Tehillim first before we go into battle. We dive into Hashem before we go into battle. The chatzotros, the trumpets, were done along with the service, just as the trumpets were done along with the karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash. So here, before you go out to war, you're going to pray. And when you do that, you will blow the trumpets. And when you blow those trumpets, and you don't do it the way the rest of the world does it, but you do it in order to daven, that is going to remember you to me, says Hashem, in a positive way. Because then I'm going to relate to you as my people who trust in me, who are not full of themselves and their own power, but they understand that everything comes from Hashem, and that will evoke the mercy that you need in order to defeat that enemy. So the chatzotros, the blowing of the trumpets, are done in contrast to what the enemy is doing. One last point about the trumpets, and that is going back to the beginning. In the first pasuk here, the second pasuk base, verse 2, we pointed out that the trumpets should be miksha, they should be one solid piece. Every time we come across this idea of miksha, I try to remember to tell you what Rav Schwab says about miksha. It's a fascinating idea. Miksha, as we said, means one solid piece. There are two other utensils that we were commanded that they be one solid piece. Who remembers the other two utensils?
Menorah.
The menorah to be one solid piece. The other one's harder to remember.
The cover of the Aron?
The cover of the Aron. The kapores. The kapores, which was the cover of the Aron, which had two kruvim, the cherubs, on top, was one solid piece of gold that had to be formed into this cover and kruvim. And the menorah was extremely complex and very detailed, and it was made of one solid piece of gold. It's much more difficult to make something miksha. It's a lot easier to make separate pieces and then use whatever methods you know how to combine or to attach, to affix the various pieces to each other. These three utensils, the commandment was that they be miksha. Schwab points out that miksha is very difficult to make. However, miksha also lasts a lot longer. Whenever you put things together and you attach things, they can break off. They're never as strong as one solid piece to begin with. If you have one solid piece, then it is it's going to last longer. It's going to be more protected from damage. But it's very hard to do. And Rav Schwab says that there are no shortcuts. You can't figure out how to do this quickly. If you have to make it miksha, it's going to take you time. There's no way that you can't make it an assembly line. You can't have six different people do the work and then put it together. It's going to take time. That's the way it goes. with mikshas are very difficult to do. So it's difficult, there are no shortcuts, but on the other hand, it's long lasting. So Rav Schwab says these three utensils represent three different human endeavors, that there are no good shortcuts. You have no choice but to put in the work. But on the other hand, when you put in that work, the results are long-lasting. And they represent three different things. The menorah, not surprisingly, represents Torah. And as we know, there are no shortcuts in the study of Torah. You can't read the notes online and then pass the test, and now all of a sudden, now an expert in Torah.
No cliff notes?
It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way in Torah. The only way to become a Torah scholar is to spend the years and years and years and years that it takes to become a Torah scholar. There's no way around it. But on the other hand, once someone does it, then it's a long-lasting thing. It is a real acquisition. That's the menorah. The kapores, the cover of the aron, with the kruvim, with the cherubs, represents, says Rav Schwab, child rearing. Raising children, there are no shortcuts. As we know, if someone tries a shortcut, they're in big trouble. There is no other way. You just have to put in the work. There is nothing else. It's just work, 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 work. No sleep, no sleep, no sleep, no sleep. That's the way it goes. And it's the only way to raise children. On the other hand, the result, after putting in all that work, is long-lasting. So that's what the kaporos represents. What do the chatzotzros represent? What do the trumpets represent, says Rav Schwab? Says Rav Schwab, chatzotzros represent tzarchei tzibur, working for the community. Communal work has no shortcuts. Anybody who's been involved in communal work knows communal work is often thankless. Communal work is often much more than you expected it to be. And it's very difficult to do, and there are no shortcuts. If you try a shortcut, it's gonna blow up in your face. The only way to do communal work is to put in the work, put in the effort, cross every T, dot every I, and get the work done. And it takes hours and hours and days and weeks and months and years. But when done properly, again, the results are long-lasting. So these three endeavors, Torah study, raising children, and communal work, are miksha. There are no shortcuts, but the finished product is a solid finished product that will last a very long time.
Why the chatzotzros connected to?
Because that's what it was over here. That was how Moshe Rabbeinu gathered everybody. That's how he. That's how they traveled. Right? It's the chatzotzros.
Miksha sounds like kasher.
Miksha sounds like
kasher.
It is.
Kasher, yeah.
Okay.
Right. I mean, hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, hard to do, and once they're completed, hard to break. Yeah, very good, very good. Okay. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.